All right, here's where we'll begin. If you look at the little red chart that's embedded in the page in front of you, here's where we've come. We today are going to finish the Old Testament. Take off next week on the New Testament. So let's summarize where we are. The bulb at the beginning of the red chart would be creation and then narrowed down to Noah. So the first guy standing there is Noah. The next bulb would be from Noah, of course, to Abraham. And all of that takes place in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and we meet Abraham in chapter 12. And then there's the growth of the nation that goes on from there. And the first, let me put this on the board. We have the growth of the nation that takes off from there. And then it goes like this. And then there's the bracket here. That's Egypt. Right? The nation goes into Egypt. The nation actually grows in Egypt. And then there's the other bracket here. This is the three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon. That's the United Kingdom. That lasts for 120 years. That's it. That 120 years, the United Kingdom is finished after 120 years. It splits under two guys. Who were they? Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Rehoboam, Reb in the south, and Jeroboam, Jerry in the north. And the kingdom splits, and then we go through, and Israel finishes. Now, let me put up a few dates. This is around 1000 B.C. David's reign straddles 1000 B.C. We have Saul before him, Solomon after him. And then the kingdom splits, and then we have the end of this northern part is Israel, and that's finished at 722. 722 B.C., the end of Israel. That the northern 10 tribes are done. Now, as I said, they did not come back into the land as a unit. Individuals came back, obviously, but they did not come back into the land as a unit. They were taken out, and they were replaced by the Assyrians. Remember, this is the Assyrians, and this is the Babylonians. They were taken out by the Assyrians, and the Assyrians replaced them with some other people. And these other people intermarried and whatnot, and we know them as the Samaritans. And then we meet them, for example, in John chapter 4. Jesus meets the Samaritan woman at the well. And the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans and all that stuff, right? So that's the end of the northern tribes. And then we have Judah and Benjamin in the south. And this is Judah. And one of the interesting things is, of course, where do they get the word Jews? The word Jews emerges during the period that we're going to look at today, the Restoration. The word Jews emerges, and it's kind of an abbreviation of Judah. It's derived from Judah. So we now pretty commonly call these people Jews, and that's where the word comes from. All right, the northern tribes have gone into captivity to Assyria, not to come back. The southern tribes go into captivity to Babylon for 70 years, and then they do come back. And the period that we are looking at today, and I left this a little bit short, of course, but we can do better than that. This is the period we're looking at today, the period of the restoration after the 70 years. So the 70 years, now there are a couple of very common ways of dating the 70 years. Because the exile to Babylon took place over a period of time, beginning about 605 and going up to 586. And so you can measure the 70 years starting from the 605 date or from the 586 date. If you start it from the first of these, the 605, then you would end it 70 years later, which would be in 536. Excuse me. And that would be the beginning of the building of the temple. If you started at the 586 date, then you go 70 years after that, and that would be the end of the building of the temple. So it works both ways. And nobody's quite sure. I mean, scholars disagree on where we should measure the 70 years. The Old Testament Jeremiah, right, predicted that they would go into captivity for 70 years. And so it's people have puzzled over where exactly are these 70 years placed, and those are the two answers. We'll find out someday which one is correct, but either one fits, so it works. So here's where we are. We're at the period after the captivity, and now I say after the captivity, but then we're going to deal with Esther, and she's still in Babylon. And so that's all a little bit fuzzy too, because some people came back at this date and some at this date and some at this date, and Esther's late. So we're going to deal with Ezra and Nehemiah, and between those two is Esther. Ezra and Nehemiah in Jerusalem, and Esther in Babylon. So that's where we are. That sort of sets the context. And you can see from the larger chart where we are as far as the stream of things goes. Act 1, God building a nation. And then we have Act 2, a united kingdom. That's Saul, David, and Solomon. And then Act 3, the divided kingdom, which we have kind of, we haven't dealt with in a lot of detail, even though that's a pretty complicated area. And then the exile, and then Act 4, a nation restored. That's where we are, Act 4. And that brings us, intertwined with all of that, of course, are the prophets. As they are speaking to the people and asking the people to follow God, to repent and follow God, and the people keep turning back and are never very successful at that. And so what this brings us up to, this brings us up at the end of Nehemiah up to about the year 415, 420. And then we have what we call the 400 silent years between that and the time Jesus comes, right? So we have Ezra, Esther over in Babylon, and Nehemiah here, and that brings us to the end of the historical stream of the Old Testament, and we'll start next week on the New Testament, all right? Now, here's what I would like to do, if we may. Let's have, so that I'm not doing all the talking, let's have maybe... These folks over here take Ezra, and if you all would take Nehemiah, and just work through the passages that are listed there and make any notes you wish to, and then call on your own, obviously, your own understanding, your own background in Nehemiah or Ezra, and we'll come back and talk about that together, all right? Harold, I'm sorry you're on your own again. You can join these other folks. But if you would just talk through these passages as it's convenient to group at your table, and then we'll come back together. Yes. Welcome back. So good to see you.
Thank you.
I see the blood's flowing to your head.
I didn't know it wasn't. I said his concern, because the confession, that would probably make a great 5 through 7.
Yeah.
5 through 7 is where that he confesses. This is like introduction.
So the first one is concern, and the second one is confession. So
ooh, they both start with C.
Yeah, okay, what's the third one? Construction, rebuilding the no, it says rebuilding the temple.
Okay, well, that's all right. That's good.
But I don't see that.
Way down.
Yeah.
It's
421.
No, 4-6.
Explain already, are Ezra and Nehemiah, are they at the same time? Were they contemporaries, or did one of them come after the other?
No, Ezra is very early in the period. And Ezra actually doesn't arrive until chapter 7 of Ezra, of Ezra's book. Before that, it's Zerubbabel, and then about 80 years later, Ezra, and then Nehemiah.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're spread out.
Nehemiah 7 to 13.
is going to destroy it and save it.
After reading the one that says about the tortoise and the hare.
How are we doing? Need more time? We okay to come back together?
Go for it.
All right. Okay, let's come back together. Let's come back together and talk about Ezra. What Cyrus decree. What's this Cyrus decree thing, folks over here who are looking at Ezra? What is Cyrus decree? Yes, he wants them to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the house of the Lord. What happened was when they went into Babylon, it was the Babylonians who took them in, and the Babylonian kings had a policy that when they captured a land, they would take the people out of the land and take them into Babylon. Well, Cyrus came along and defeated the Babylonians, and his decree was policy was the opposite. He sent them back into their own land. Set them up with their own gods, set them up with their own temples, and Lord willing, they'd all be happy. So that was his policy, and so Cyrus decrees that the peoples would go back to their own lands, and among those peoples were the Jews. So they go back. But here's the really interesting thing. Most of you know this. Let me read you from Isaiah, right? Isaiah takes place back, the diagram that I erased is back here, before the captivity, right? This is the end of the captivity, after 70 years of captivity. Now let me read you from the end, the last verse of Isaiah 44 and the first verse of chapter 45. Speaking of God, there's a whole list of things said about him. Who says of Cyrus, who's going to come along 70 years later, who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and will accomplish all that I please. He will say of Jerusalem, let it be rebuilt, and of the temple, let its foundations be laid. This is what the Lord says to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I take hold of, to subdue nations before him, and to strip kings of their armor, to open doors before him, so that gates will not be shut. Now, what happens is, liberal scholars say that must have been written after the time of Cyrus, or at least at the time of Cyrus. So it couldn't have been written before the captivity because Cyrus came 70 years later. Therefore, the first half of Isaiah may be before the captivity, but the second half of Isaiah must have been written afterwards because how could anybody know the name of Cyrus beforehand, right? There are a number of statements, and I'm not going to take time to go through them. There are a number of statements in the second half of Isaiah that go something like this. I am doing something that no one else has done, says God. He's foretelling that Cyrus is going to rescue the people out of captivity. And he points it out as something unique. It's kind of a big flashing light in the Old Testament that says God can predict the future in detail. So as to name the king Cyrus, who's going to rescue the people from the land. Amazing, amazing feature of Isaiah.
Wouldn't it be startling to bend Cyrus?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they bring out these old
Let me show you this old book here. Yeah. 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 Absolutely, yeah. Amazing. All right. Chapter 3, we have building of the altar. When the people begin their task, right? The point of Ezra is building the temple. So they begin with building the altar. And why? Why did they begin with building the altar? Yeah. It's not just the mechanics of building the temple, it's making the place of worship. And in order to initiate the worship as, I mean, I'm speculating. In order to initiate the worship as early as possible, they build the altar first. And then they can carry on the worship, and they can otherwise go on with building the temple. And so we come down to verse 8 of chapter 3, and we have building the temple. What do we have in chapter 6, verses 14 to 15? Did you guys fill in the blanks here? The temple? Yeah, the temple completed, the temple finished. The temple is finished, and they have a time of celebration at the finishing of the temple. It has taken 20 years. The building of the temple has taken 20 years. They started it, and then they got opposition from these other people who had inhabited the land while they were away in exile. These other peoples came in and started to give them a lot of flack. And so the work on the temple was stalled. And then there was opposition from inside their own people and discouragement and all kinds of things. It's a really interesting study. Of course, we went through this last year, Ezra and Nehemiah, in more detail in this class. But we have the temple finished. And after 20 years, the temple is finished. Now, Ezra has still not appeared. There are actually three, that little short period after the captivity that I had up here can be divided into three parts. The three returns of people from exile, three batches of people coming back from exile. The first one takes place under Zerubbabel. That's what we just talked about. And the building of the temple was initiated by Zerubbabel. That's the first six chapters of Ezra. Beginning in chapter 7 of Ezra, we have the return under Ezra. So he doesn't actually show up. The book is named Ezra, but Ezra himself, the man, doesn't show up until chapter 7. So we have Zerubbabel in 1 to 6, then we have Ezra in 7 to, what is it, 10? 7. Ezra takes us from 7 through 10. And then, so the first return under Zerubbabel, the second return under Ezra, and then the third return is going to be under Nehemiah. About 80 years later, I think, about 80 years after that, comes Nehemiah. Because Nehemiah is in Babylon and he hears, you know, the temple's built okay, but the walls are still lying in ruins. And so we come to Nehemiah. But let's finish Ezra first. Ezra comes in chapter 7 to Jerusalem. And then what do we, somebody read for us, please, over here, Ezra 7, chapter 7, verse 10.
For Ezra devoted himself to the study and observance of the law of the Lord, and to teaching his decrees and laws in Israel.
Ezra devoted himself. Now, I call that Ezra's heart. Whatever you want to put in there to reflect that same idea, I think. We saw the heart of Saul, David, and Solomon, right? Kind of mixed. Here we come to Ezra. Here's Ezra's heart. Ezra devoted himself to the study of the law, to the doing of the law, and to the teaching of the law. And so Ezra comes along and becomes a reformer in Israel. And the problem that he faces, he and Nehemiah face different problems, but the problem that he faces is the problem of intermarriage. I already talked about these people whom the king had sent back into the land, and they intermarried with the people there, and they became the Samaritans. Well, the Israelites who came back from captivity themselves began to intermarry with the people of the land. Now remember, and here's the issue. We saw the issue when we looked at Solomon, right? What was Solomon's problem with his wives? That he married all these wives from all these different countries, and they all brought their gods with them. And he began to be, and so, you know, if mama ain't happy, no one's happy. So he begins to make places for all these idols that they brought with them. And then we have the whole land filled with idolatry. And so what happened here was these people came back to the land after the captivity, and they began to intermarry with these pagan peoples. And we have it in the New Testament, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. And that's exactly what they were doing. They were unequally yoked with unbelievers. And so Ezra deals with it. Now, the way Ezra and Nehemiah deal with the problems is it's an Old Testament way of dealing with it. How does Ezra respond to this whole issue? What's his response when he finds out about all this intermarriage with idolaters?
It's a negative response.
Negative response. Yeah. Can you give us a little more detail?
Stripping clothes and sitting down.
Yeah. Tearing. Is he the one who tore his hair out?
Tears
his hair out. Sackcloth and ashes, mourning. Just really vexed. That's the best word I can think of. At this, just totally vexed at this state of affairs that the people, it's not, so I think he sees it like this. The idea was that God would bring the people into the land and plant them in the land as God's people in God's place. Instead of that, they begin to intermarry with these unbelievers and they're going to become assimilated. They're going to become assimilated to the cultures around them, and they're going to lose their identity. And this totally vexes Ezra, and he goes into what does he do in relation to the people who had intermarried? Let's go to chapter 9. Ezra chapter 9, verse 1. After these things had been done, the leader came and said, "The people of Israel, including the priests and Levites, have not kept themselves separate from the neighboring peoples with their detestable practices, like those of the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites." Those were all the kind of idolatry that we read about in connection with Solomon. Verse 2, they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves, and their sons have mingled with the holy race with the peoples around them, and the leaders and the officials have led the way in this unfaithfulness. When I heard this, I tore my tunic and cloak, pulled the hair from my head and beard, and sat down appalled. That's the word this version uses, appalled. And then he goes to the people, and we won't take time to go into the detail, but he goes to the people and says, "Look, you need to straighten up and separate yourselves from these pagan wives and get straight with God." That was Ezra's reform. The book of Ezra falls into two parts: building the temple and reforming the people. The book of Nehemiah falls into two parts: building the wall and reforming the people. They had to deal with both a physical problem and a spiritual problem. Now let's move to Nehemiah. In Nehemiah, in scene 2A, we have. let me start our little diagrams on the board. Here's scene 1. We'll just take it all together, scene 1A and B, building the temple. So I thought, how on earth are we going to represent the temple? Well, how's that? I know the temple didn't have a steeple, but symbolic. Ezra had the temple built, and without actually trying to draw a picture of the temple, that's my symbol for it. All right, now we come to Nehemiah. I called the first part of this in verses 1 through 4 Nehemiah's burden. Where do we meet? Somebody describe for us what we read in the first four verses of chapter 1.
It's his confession of their sins and transgressions.
Yeah. Yep. Where is Nehemiah? In Babylon, right? Nehemiah's in Babylon. He is serving the king there. He's an official in the court of the king. And he's a cupbearer, right? Kind of important post. The guy who guarantees that the king is not going to be poisoned. And so he is the cupbearer of the king, and he hears that, he gets a message that the walls of Jerusalem are lying in ruins. The temple's been built okay, but the walls are still lying in ruins. And so Nehemiah just becomes vexed like Ezra. He becomes burdened and confesses the sins of the people, and he makes a request of the king, right? What's it? How do you imagine? I don't know. Nehemiah may have known that this guy was this king was sympathetic. I don't know what the personality of the king was like, but Nehemiah goes to him and says, "I'd like to go back to Jerusalem and build the walls, and I'd like you to provide protection for me, because we're going into kind of going through hostile territory."
See, I just want to make an observation here. I think Nehemiah was probably Italian, because it says that when he was in the presence of the king said, "Why are you so sad?" Couldn't hide his feelings.
Yeah. If you work at it, you could get all the prophets to be Italian. You know, there's Malachi and there's Nehemiah. And, So Nehemiah goes to the king and he makes his request. And here's what we read. Verse 6 of chapter 1. "Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night. For your servants, the people of Israel, I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself." He's not being formal here. "I confess our sins." He says, "I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses." What's that about? Do you ever pray like that? I don't think Nehemiah did those things. I don't think Nehemiah had to confess those things. Why did he do it? Because he identified so closely with the people that he assumed the burden of their sins and confessed them as his own sins? Is that what's going on here? That Nehemiah felt such a burden for the people that he made himself one with the people and said, "Lord, we have sinned against you," even though he himself personally had not. That's Nehemiah. Yeah.
Understanding that if it were not maybe for the grace of God, so. So, I mean, that's what it seems like.
Yeah.
It seems like he's interceding and he recognizes his own inclination toward doing the very sins that he's confessing.
As opposed to saying, "Lord, please forgive these poor sinners." Yeah, that's Nehemiah. If we saw Ezra's heart in getting to know the law, practicing the law, and teaching the law, here's Nehemiah's heart in identifying himself with the people and taking the burden of their sins upon himself and confessing on their behalf. And so his request is, it's please send me to Jerusalem, provide protection, provide materials for the wall and all that stuff. And then his confession is just really remarkable. And then in chapter 4, we have the rebuilding of the wall, the building of the wall. All right. What I listed there several verses from chapter 4 to be representative. Chapter 4, verse 6 talks about rebuilding the wall. What about verses 21 and 6:15? What did y'all gather from that? Yeah.
Their weapons ready.
Yeah.
They were attacked.
Yeah.
So that took a lot of emotional and physical strength for 52 days.
Yeah. Didn't he set them up two by two in pairs? One guy building, the other guy guarding?
Yes.
And then they'd switch off?
Yes. I said guarding and working day and night.
Yeah. Yeah. They had, I don't know whether they had shift work, but they certainly were guarding 24 hours a day. And I don't know whether they had shift work on the building, but they were building the walls, and it took them how long to build to finish building the walls? 52 days. This is the wall of a city, right? And it's been torn down, and the stones are all pretty handy. They're there, but if you ever tore down a wall and tried to rebuild it by putting the stone, I mean that's not kid stuff. And so in 52 days, what does this tell us about Nehemiah? Remember the first thing that we're told about Nehemiah when he comes into the city, what does he do? He takes a party by night and goes out and scopes out the job. He says, here's what lies ahead of us. He goes and reconnoiters the wall and with a small group of people, and then this guy's very, very, this guy's a great manager. This guy's a great organizer. He's got things well organized. And so he positions these people at this part of the wall and these people at this part. And he gives them their assignments to build that part of the wall. And they're organized in such a way that some of them can guard and some of them can build. And it's just really quite amazing how he organizes things. Very, very remarkable. So they're building and guarding at the same time.
Well, had to be one of the guards.
Yeah. You don't want to lift the stones.
Lindsay, may I make a comment?
Sure.
Without diversion.
Okay.
I'm thinking of timing. In modern day times, I can't think of anything that takes 20 years build, except the building of your family. At most, we have 20 years from the conception and birth of a child until they're on their own to be independent. We usually do not spend 20 years in the building of a house.
Right, yeah.
Or
yeah.
A barn.
Yeah.
Or even a church.
Yeah.
But 20 years is a block of time.
Yeah. It's a big job.
But for 20 years, they diligently worked on the temple.
On the temple, yeah.
Because it was important.
Yeah. Yeah. They did have interruptions. They had long periods of interrupting the work. But you're right. They persevered, and over 20 years, they got it built. Nehemiah comes along to rebuild the wall, and 52 days he's got the job done. Yeah. It's a different situation. Yeah, yeah, very helpful. Now, to finish up, oh my gracious, our time's okay. Sorry. Let's finish Nehemiah. We meet Ezra at chapter 8, verse 2. Ezra comes in and reads the law. And then in verse 8, they, what do you think the blank is there? Yeah, not in chapter 9. What about verse 8? They make it clear. They not only read the law, but they make it clear. They translated it. Is it? Yeah. Or for the preachers, they expounded it. They All right. So they make the law clear, and then in chapter 9, verse 3, they confess and worship. And again, there's fasting and sackcloth. There's a reading of the day is divided into parts, and for a third of the time they read the law, and for a third of the time they confess their sins, and for a third of the time they worship. And it's just, I mean, it's just a really remarkable scene as we think about their situation. All right, so if that's the temple, then in scene two we have the wall. How's that for simple? They're going to build. They build the wall around the city. It wasn't square like that. That's just symbolic. But they build the wall around the city. So Ezra gets their relationship with God on track, and Nehemiah protects them from the enemies around. All right, we need to wrap things up. With Esther. Let me, if I may, just sort of skim through very quickly Esther like this. You know the story of Esther. There was a queen, Vashti, and this is in Babylon between the times of Ezra and Nehemiah. That is between the times of the history of the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. Esther is crowned as queen. Vashti is deposed because she refuses to... She refuses the king to make a display of her. They had the men's dinner and the women's dinner. So y'all been in that situation? We went to a wedding once in Jarkent in Kazakhstan, and we had the men's dinner, and then we got to go to the women's dinner afterwards. This was a wedding, and they had separate men's dinner and women's dinner. They're not going to eat together. And so that's the situation that you have in the case of in the book of Esther. Esther's in the women's dinner, and the king wants to bring her in and display her because she's beautiful to the men, and she refuses. The men are all drunk, and you know what would happen. So Esther then is chosen to replace Vashti. And the king doesn't know that Esther's Jewish. And so Esther requests relief for the Jews in chapter 7. Haman comes along with his plot, gets the king to sign a decree that the Jews are to be wiped out, and legislatively that can't be changed. And so they come up with an idea of coming up with another decree to let the Jews defend themselves, and by the help of God, they defend themselves against the soldiers, and they are preserved. So what we have in the case of Esther is, I think, something like this. Here are the people in the land, and God protects them. That is, in the land of Babylon, and God protects them. Just a circle around a figure. Ezra comes into the land and builds the temple. Nehemiah comes into the land and builds the wall. And Ezra illustrates the fact that in the meantime, God is keeping the people who are still in captivity safe. He wants them to come back into the land also. He's got it all under control. He has the temple first, then the wall, and then the people in the land, and they're all It's all looked after. God's got it. He can handle it. He can do more than one thing at a time.